Opioid deaths are at their lowest level since 2015. We're learning about the most recent data from the State Department of Health Services on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The health agency has a new data tracking tool. It found an estimated 1 in 6 Wisconsin adults were prescribed and used an opioid in the past year. Top reasons, surgeries and back pain. How do you want to see DHS address the opioid crisis? Do you think that improved data will help us get control of this epidemic? We're at 800-642-1234. Paul Krupski is the Opioid Initiatives Director for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me back.
So we know from this new tool, your new data, most recent data, that the number of opioid deaths last year was around 840. And so that shows a decline. How significant is that?
So the decline is about 10% compared to 2017 data. And it's a very encouraging sign that's the way that we view it. 1 year definitely does not make a trend. But I think that seeing that significant of a decrease provides us confidence that the ongoing efforts that we have now been investing in and working with our many partners and stakeholders statewide on for the past half a decade, even longer now, is beginning to really show that intended effect that we had. We are confident that we had a strong plan in place and knew what our targeted efforts needed to be, but we didn't, like anything else, we unfortunately need time. We need time for things to be implemented, for programs and services to be running at a level that we expect to see ultimately this this positive change that we can now identify in the decrease in deaths.
Can you break down the types of opioids responsible here for these deaths? How much of this was due to heroin versus prescription opioids or synthetic opioids?
Yeah, so that's one of the great parts about these DataDirect dashboards is that that's something that you can actually filter on the DEST dashboard. You can search by a specific type of opioid, so prescription drugs versus heroin versus the synthetic opioids, which going back a few years now, we are now seeing the largest number of deaths attributed to. Right now, the majority, going back the last couple of years, the majority of deaths are being attributed to those synthetics. So primarily fentanyl is what is most people hear about through the news. Fentanyl is now laced with other drugs as well, such as cocaine or methamphetamine. So it's become a larger problem, and that's where we're seeing the largest number of deaths. Heroin and then prescription drugs are now kind of right at about the same rate. Seeing the same number of deaths attributed to those. So it's the synthetics that are definitely leading the way, but heroin and prescription drugs still an issue as well, for sure.
Paul, from this new data, we see that hospital ER visits for all opioid overdoses in Wisconsin increased by 64% between 2014 and 2018. What's going on there with emergency room visits?
So emergency room visits have definitely increased, as you said, but between 2017 and 2018, they were more stagnant. But the sharp increase in going back to 2014 to now, I think, again, is really attributable to the rise in synthetic opioids that we have seen. The potency is just so much higher that is really what is leading to more overdoses happening, and obviously more visits to the emergency rooms, and as I mentioned already too, unfortunately more deaths. So I believe that's really attributable to the rise in synthetics.
We're getting updated on new data that show a drop in opioid related deaths in Wisconsin. Paul Krupski is head of opioid initiatives for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. You can join in with your questions about the data, 800-642-1234. So, Paul, you also found that 1 in 6 adults were prescribed and used an opioid in the past year. Is that about right on for what you would think with opioid prescriptions?
So there has been a lot of work done over the past many years, several years now, just to provide more education and awareness and information to prescribers so that they can better understand levels that opioids should be prescribed, what some other pain management alternatives could be to opioids. So those types of efforts, and we have seen a very sharp decrease in the number of opioid prescriptions here in Wisconsin. Going back 4 or 5 years now, we have seen over 1.5 million less opioid prescriptions written here in the state of Wisconsin. So we know that prescribers are more aware now when considering writing these prescriptions, having those different types of conversations with the patients. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, opioids are still needed in certain situations. And surgeries tend to be when, or not tend to be, they are, as you mentioned, when the most prescriptions are written. And so it's about when those prescriptions are written now, making sure that the patient is educated on what opioids, how they need to be used, what they should or should not be used with, and then also that the prescriber is only prescribing the amount of opioids that are actually needed, that we're not getting a prescription written for 50 pills, say, when really a prescription for 10 will do. So there are definitely less prescriptions that are being written. There's less pills that are being provided to individuals, and I think that's a positive sign in what we're seeing.
We saw state spending on the opioid epidemic. It went from $5 million in 2016 to nearly $25 million this year. Where is the funding going, and where do you see room for some real changes on the horizon to fight this crisis?
So the big uptick in funding was really attributable to the federal government funding that was passed. First, the 21st Century Cures Act under the Obama administration, followed by the Support Act in the current Trump administration, which provided grants to all states in larger sums of money to really make that bigger impact at the state level. And the great part about it was it allowed states flexibility for how they wanted to use that funding. So our efforts here at DHS, we were able to invest across all levels of care, from prevention to intervention, treatment, and recovery. And I believe that well-rounded approach is really what is beginning to show these positive outcomes. You know, we need to make sure that we're preventing people from becoming addicted in the first place, or the opportunity to misuse these drugs in the first place. We want to make sure that treatment is available for those that need it, and then supporting them along the journey of recovery, making sure that they have all of those different types of support services along the way, that they can be successful in recovery. And when we go back to what our latest press release was about with this data direct opioids, you know, data is the ultimate driver for us. We make data driven decisions on where we need to be investing in. So the data that we look into, that we collect at the department, that shows us, you know, unfortunately there isn't enough money to take everything everywhere. So we have to target those high need counties, those high need areas of the state where we see higher numbers of deaths or overdoses, to really make sure that we are targeting those areas of the state that need it most. And that's the approach that we've taken with the additional funding we've received.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Paul Krupski is the Opioid Initiatives Director for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We have a link to DHS's opioid dashboard. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. Coming up, we're looking at life-saving drugs that curb cravings and treat the symptoms of opioid addiction. That's back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about drugs that could have a key role in helping a person with opioid use disorder to stop using. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are drugs like methadone and buprenorphine, which are opioids themselves that are used to curb withdrawals. And there are drugs known as opioid antagonists that act in the brain. But how do these meds all fit into the long-term treatment of addiction? And what do physicians think of them? What questions do you have about medically assisted treatment for opioid dependence? Have you been down this road? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Michael Miller is a clinical instructor in the UW-Madison Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. He's a board-certified general and addiction psychiatrist, certified in addiction medicine by the American Board of Preventive Medicine. Dr. Miller, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
So can you start by explaining the whole idea of medication-assisted treatment for opioid use? What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean is using a drug to treat drug addiction. And there are some medications that have been found through clinical trials to help significantly for people that are trying to achieve abstinence, trying to maintain abstinence. And this goes back to methadone's introduction in the late 1960s was the research published. And I think the first federally approved methadone clinics were in the early 70s. The use of medication for, at that time it was all heroin addiction, is an important advance that really improves outcomes and, in fact, saves lives. The data is quite clear that opioid overdose deaths are greatly reduced in a cohort of patients given these medications as opposed to people that don't take them if you did a double-blind comparison study.
Well, opioid use disorder is chronic. There can be relapse. Do these prescribed drugs help with that?
Well, you're sort of getting to the question of how long does someone stay on them?
Mm-hmm.
And for a chronic disease, does it mean that you're treated with them for the rest of your life? Some people are treated the rest of their lives. And from my standpoint and that of most addiction medicine doctors, that's really okay because we're trying to help people be functional. But most people stay on these medications a year or two. If you stay on them less than 3 months, your outcomes are not much different than if you hadn't tried them at all. But they're very important in stabilizing the brain because they stabilize so many things. They stabilize your endocrine system, your stress hormones, and even your sex hormones. They obviously can prevent the withdrawal that drives people back to using. So they're an important intervention. They are not necessarily recovery. They are not recovery. People have to work on recovery and changing their lives, changing their attitudes, changing their relationships, changing their connections.
So it's one piece.
It's a piece. It's mm-hmm. an important piece, but it's not the only intervention.
Let's talk about buprenorphine, which is one of the medications. How does that work? When did it come on the scene?
Buprenorphine reached retail pharmacies in Madison in the spring of 2003, and I think I was the first person to prescribe. There was only one pharmacy that had it when they first began shipping it out. Clinical trials were done for a number of years before that, and colleagues in Milwaukee were using it in clinical trials. It's a very unique opioid, and it's important to recognize that, again, in your intro, you mentioned there's an antagonist available that only blocks the receptor. Buprenorphine and methadone also block opioid receptors, but they themselves are opioids. Buprenorphine is quite unique, however. It turns on the receptor only partially, and it gloms onto the receptor and doesn't leave. The slow dissociation, when I give my lectures, I talk about it's like a bad relative who comes and just won't get off the couch.
nice.
And so it sticks to the opioid receptor so that when another opioid tries to crowd in, there's no place for it to go. And so oxycodone, morphine, heroin would have no place to act. So the basic therapeutic things that these medicines do is they stop the immediate withdrawal, which is so uncomfortable. They stabilize physiology. They block receptors so other opioids have no place to work. And in the case of buprenorphine, I actually think from my long clinical experience with this, they really have some impact on your emotional regulation as well. If I have a patient who notices they're very depressed and they have opioid addiction, I won't give them an antidepressant until I put them on buprenorphine and see what happens to their mood when they're stable. And if they still have depression, I can add an antidepressant. But buprenorphine is a really interesting drug, and it's safer than all full opioid agonists. So oxycodone, hydromorphone, all the different pain medications turn on the receptor completely and overdoses happen. Buprenorphine has what's called a ceiling effect. It only can work partially. It works just enough to give you all the therapeutic benefits, but no one has ever died from a buprenorphine overdose just using buprenorphine alone. So it's safer.
We're looking at using drugs to help in the treatment of addiction. Dr. Michael Miller is a clinical instructor in UW-Madison's Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. You can join in with your questions. What do you want to know about medically assisted treatment for opioid dependence? Have you or a loved one used this treatment protocol? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alex from Watertown called in to say that he's seen a lot of people coming off heroin using methadone or Suboxone. In his experience, he noticed that these people tend to go back to using, and he thinks drugs encourage relapse. Is this a belief you're trying to combat at all, Dr. Miller?
Absolutely. The statistics are that relapse rates are less when people take it, but he's getting to a point that's very important, and we talked about this earlier, duration of treatment. There's really excellent data that when you pull away these medications, especially if you do it too soon, not only does relapse happen, but mortality goes up.
Why is that the case?
Oh, because when people return to full agonists, especially if their tolerance is down, they can die from taking what they used to take, the heroin they used to take. Anybody who's using opioids these days from the street is taking a huge risk because you never know what's in the product that you've bought. And fentanyl is in so many samples of heroin now, and fentanyl is so much more powerful than morphine or heroin. So yes, relapse can happen, but this is where I was referencing before. These medications are not recovery. People need to address their addiction, go through therapy, consider being in a support group with peers, learn new ways of coping, and really build the sort of functionalities again, build the bridges back to their family and to their job, to school, so that when the medications are taken away, things are stable. This is, you know, people say, oh, I don't want to take these medications. These are a crutch. Well, when you break your leg, you sure want a crutch. If you got rid of all crutches, people would be hobbling around when they break a leg. But if you put a cast on that leg for the right amount of time and allow healing to take place, then you can take away the cast, take away the crutch, and the person can walk. So you have to have healing take place during the period of time you're on meds. If the person is just taking a med and not changing anything else about their life, and especially if they remain actively involved with other drugs like cocaine or methamphetamine or cannabis while they're on this while they're on these medications, you pull the medications away, and relapse is very, very common.
So the FDA says buprenorphine is supposed to be used in conjunction with counseling, in conjunction with behavioral therapies. What kind of behavioral therapies are we talking about here? What does that support look like?
Well, the addiction treatment that goes along with medication is the same addiction treatment that people receive if they're not on medication. It's cognitive behavioral therapy, it's rational emotive therapy, it's motivational enhancement therapy, it could be 12-step facilitation therapy. In general, group therapy works better than individual therapy, but people can see a therapist individually, but groups work better in all of my experience.
Why is that?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. There's a book that's been written on why group therapy works, and you don't feel alone. You get ideas from others. You can have vicarious learning. You can be challenged by the group. There's something called consensual validation. If you have a therapist that says, would you think maybe rethink that approach you have? Person could go, why the hell should I rethink it? When you have a room full of 10 people saying, you really might want to rethink this, that really has an impact on human psychology to realize, wait a minute, I'm the lone wolf here. Maybe I do need to change the way I'm thinking about this. So groups can be very, very helpful.
Peers can have a real impact here in that recovery.
Absolutely.
We're talking about the fight against the opioid epidemic by treating drugs with drugs, basically, as part of a long-term treatment plan where patients remain on some form of medication to help with recovery for years. Psychiatrist Michael Miller is a clinical instructor in the UW-Madison Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. He stays with us. U of a line, 800-642-1234. Are you on a medically assisted treatment for addiction? Have you run into issues accessing your prescriptions? How do you think physicians can best help patients struggling with opioid abuse? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation after a news update on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at long-term treatment options for opioid addiction. And it seems counterintuitive to treat an addiction to a drug with another drug. We're talking about it on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So some call it fighting fire with fire, using opioids like methadone or buprenorphine to eliminate withdrawal symptoms without providing the high that other opioids do. We're getting a better understanding, though, of what medication-assisted treatment can do to help people sustain recovery. How do you think physicians can best help patients struggling with opioid abuse? Does your treatment plan include a prescription? How is that going? Can you get the prescription filled? Join in at 800-642-1234. Psychiatrist Michael Miller is a clinical instructor in the UW-Madison Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Chris is joining us from Richland Center this morning. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hi. Yeah, I'm actually a former patient of Dr. Miller's. Hello, Dr. Miller. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning.
So I have been, I actually started through the New Start Clinic in Madison as one of your patients. And, that was like, I'm going to say 11 years ago. And I am still on medication, buprenorphine and naloxone. And my dose is significantly reduced. But I still do take it, and it just, you know, there's, I guess, I just want to say that if you get into the right program and you follow the instructions of your physician or your psychiatrist and you get the group therapy and the help that you need and really stick with stuff, these programs really do work. And I had tried and failed several other times, you know, without medication, and I've recommended several of friends or associates, I guess, to go to the same clinic. They've had success there. My girlfriend is on a medication assisted recovery plan, and she's been clean for 5 years now. And
Chris, may I ask you, how do you feel today?
Great, great. I don't even really think about it much, other than I still have to see my doctor and check in and, you know, make sure I'm clean. And, you know, every so often, however often they decide I need to do it.
Dr. Miller, Dr. Miller, what do you see about Chris's trajectory? Is this common?
This is a great story, and it is common. Recovery happens all the time. And for Chris, it happened with medication. And, you know, so many people say, when you start these medicines, the most important thing is to get the person off. You need to have a strategy for stopping it. Some states have legislated that, in fact. They've said any doctor who prescribes buprenorphine has to have a plan to get the person off in X number of months. Really, what's the goal here? Is it to be medication-free or is it to be well? Chris is well. And Chris's story is very, very common. After a couple of years, the dose you need for maintenance does decrease. So you might be taking 8, 12, 14 milligrams a day in the first couple of years. When you get out to 5 years, 8 years, you might be taking 6, 4, or even 2 milligrams. It is maintenance treatment. And what Chris is sharing is that he is functional. He's functional in his relationships. He's, you know, he feels good every day. What my patients tell me, got a little frog in my throat, sorry. What my patients tell me, excuse me, is that what they notice is that when they're taking this medication, buprenorphine, they tell me, I feel normal again. I feel like the person before I ever took an opioid. It really does something that's restorative. And so I'm delighted to hear Chris's story. I'm delighted we had a caller with 11 years of successful maintenance treatment. And as he said, I worked at New Start for 21 years. Mm-hmm. And it was always, you don't get the medication without the counseling. They come as a package. He followed the instructions. He did what he was advised to do. And he's got a functional life now to show for it.
Let's go to Mary now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Now, coming off of that other story, I say, like, my boyfriend, too, you know, had a great doctor and success story about, you know, and kind of told him that he could be a, it'd be like a lifelong, you know, addiction or could be a lifelong problem to have. But as long as he keeps up with the Suboxone treatments, which he has done, until, like, well, recently, he has a job with the field, but that comes with private insurance, which doesn't cover, you know, all the costs for that and whatnot.
Mary,
so it's a problem.
Yeah, Mary, it's sounding a little bit muffled here, but I'm understanding that there is an inability to pay the insurance deductible. Dr. Miller, what are you seeing there?
Well, actually, this may be a whole other topic for another show, which is the whole thing of people being switched to high-deductible health plans so that when your new calendar year comes up, you're paying 100% of the cost for your health care until you reach the deductible. And health care is pretty expensive, whether it's medications for any condition, for arthritis, for, you know, Crohn's disease, for heart disease. If you're paying 100% of your medication costs up to your deductible of $2,000 or $5,000, that's a big financial hit. That's a different issue. There are patient assistance programs for buprenorphine products made by the manufacturers of Suboxone and Zubsolve and Bunavail, but you generally have to pass a means test, I believe. And if you've got means, and it's just that you've got a high-deductible health plan, I mean, I really have a problem with these high-deductible health plans, especially when it comes to addiction care and mental health care. These medications aren't free, okay? In general, Suboxone was the first one. It's got the market dominance, maybe 80% of the market or more. It used to be a dollar a milligram, basically, and this can add up. If it's $12 a day, that's $400 a month, and so we're getting up there for people that, you know, live in paycheck to paycheck. If you are on a self-pay basis, it is tougher.
We're talking about medically assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, which is a chronic relapsing condition. Psychiatrist Michael Miller is a clinical instructor in the UW-Madison Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. You can join in. How do you want to see physicians and pharmacists address our state's opioid crisis? Do you think there are barriers to getting treatment? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Miller, federal legislation requires providers to get additional training and permission from the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to prescribe buprenorphine. It's known as an X waiver. Are there challenges to this X waiver model?
Tremendous challenges. When this bill passed in the beginning of this century, the way the bill was constructed was evidence of the ambivalence that America has about addiction and medication-assisted treatment. Oh, we're going to approve this medication, but, you know, we wish we didn't have to. We're going to put some strings on it. And the big deal then was, oh, what if this stuff gets diverted? What if it gets into the wrong hands? Which is a whole other topic. But the research on diversion of buprenorphine, one person giving it to another, shows that That happens mostly when the person receiving it needed it to get through withdrawal or used it to treat their own addiction and had financial or other barriers to finding a doctor to prescribe or a nurse practitioner, physician assistant to prescribe. So when the law was passed, it said you can have up to 30 patients in your first year and up to 100 patients. For physicians who have a full certification in addiction like me, the cap has been raised to 275 patients. The irony is there is no cap on the number of patients you can have to treat with oxycodone or hydrocodone for pain. You can treat 1,000 patients for pain. Some of those people will develop addiction. This medication is so much safer than all of those. And so having a census cap really is discriminatory, and the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which is the largest physician organization, I served as president about a dozen years ago, we've now come out with a policy position that we are supporting bills in Congress to get rid of the X waiver. Why do you need special training to prescribe this, but you don't need special training to provide opioids to people that may result in addiction?
Is there a stigma around it as well, a physician having to get extra training in order to be able to prescribe it?
Absolutely. I mean, I personally think that, and the data shows, methadone is much trickier to use and more dangerous to use. If there's anything that should require extra training, it's methadone. But there's no training required for methadone clinic doctors, just for buprenorphine prescribers. And there's a lot of pressure to change those federal regulations, change those laws, now that we know how buprenorphine works, what the long-term results of buprenorphine are, how people don't die from a buprenorphine overdose. It just doesn't happen because of the ceiling effect I discussed. So maybe we'll see the end of the census caps, and maybe if education requirements are maintained, they'll be for prescribing this and any opioid. So it's a very much in flux legislative environment right now.
Why would some pharmacists then be reluctant to stock it?
I think that's really unfortunate. There are several trends. I think they're somewhat related. You have emergency departments or primary care clinics putting up signs saying this is an opioid-free zone. We don't prescribe any opioids at all. We have doctors refusing to prescribe opioids and doctors saying, I'm not going to prescribe buprenorphine. I had just seen a story that came out recently of some pharmacies refusing to stock it or refusing to fill prescriptions for it. That is blatant discrimination and very unfortunate. The scenario in the one article talked about how the pharmacist didn't want people loitering outside the pharmacy. I mean, I've never seen that sort of thing happening. But I think that pharmacists that don't prescribe it, I have a problem with the ethics of that. I really do.
Psychiatrist Michael Miller is with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 2 million Americans struggle with opioid use disorder. The FDA has approved several drugs to treat opioid addiction. They help alleviate painful symptoms associated with the disorder, but access to medication-assisted treatment could be a challenge. So what questions do you have about opioid use disorder treatment? Have you relapsed? What is it like for you or a loved one to recover? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Michael Miller stays with us. He's a board-certified addiction psychiatrist and is certified in addiction medicine by the American Board of Preventive Medicine. Let's go back to the phone. Let's not go back to the phones. I think we just had a caller drop, but I want to touch on Dr. Miller. Naltrexone, which is a long-lasting injection that blocks the effects of opioids, not an opioid itself, could that greatly reduce the risk of abuse?
It does. Naltrexone is not abusable. It's not an opioid. It doesn't produce reward. It only blocks the receptor. There have been head-to-head studies that show that it's as effective as buprenorphine. For those who haven't dropped out, the dropout rates are much higher. with it, and that has to do with the complexity of getting someone on it. When someone has opioid addiction, they have physical dependence that goes along with it, and when you stop taking your opioid, you can go through some physical symptoms, but emotionally you can be very, very miserable. And one of the main reasons people continue to use opioids is because of the misery of withdrawal. And you need to stop, according to the package insert, you need to stop using all opioids for at least a week before you start naltrexone. A lot of people just can't make it a week.
Oh.
So there are problems in transition from active addiction to naltrexone maintenance. But for those who are on naltrexone maintenance, they can do very well with it.
Is it perhaps an easier prescription to fill? Is there better access to it?
Well, you know, with buprenorphine, doctors and other prescribers know, oh, I can't prescribe that unless I have special training, 8 hours of training, for a nurse practitioner, 24 hours is required by Congress. And I need this waiver thing. And they think, oh, I need special training or permission to use naltrexone. Not true. It's not a controlled substance. It's not an opioid. Anybody with any prescribing authority, you don't even have to have a DEA license to prescribe morphine. You need nothing except a medical license or a prescribing authority through your state. So naltrexone, finding prescribers should be easier. The long-acting form of naltrexone is a once every several weeks injection. That is not more complicated than other injection therapies, so medical assistants can give those. Can medical assistants give injections? Certainly LPNs can and RNs can. So it's an intramuscular injection. So it is easier, but because, again, you've mentioned stigma, there's stigma within the medical profession, and there are doctors that say, I just don't want to do that. I don't want to be involved with those patients, even though people in their own caseload have this problem that they may not recognize that they could help. So I do encourage physicians to become prescribers of these medications, naltrexone and buprenorphine, in their office-based practices. It should be a part of general medical care, just like now treatment of depression is part of general medical care.
So outside of the medications we've talked about, the treatment protocols we've talked about so far, are there other treatment options coming down the pipeline that show promise in clinical trials here?
Well, I haven't seen what's happening, and part of the reason this is complicated, big pharma doesn't invest much in addiction. And that's not necessarily because of stigma. That's because of economics. They don't make a lot of money off of it. And the thing that's interesting is, I mean, some researchers have made a career of doing research on adoption of medication treatment for addiction. And the punchline is adoption is low. Relatively few patients are on medications because there are philosophical biases, even amongst counselors that say you shouldn't be on it. A lot of AA and NA sponsors say don't be on it. There's a lot of negativism about these treatments, and it's not like everybody with addiction is treated with one of these medications. Far from it. So I don't know what's in the pipeline. What may be important to address are some non-approved treatments. I was very concerned when I saw that when New York State approved its medical marijuana law, it said that marijuana could be used as a treatment of opioid addiction. There is no proof of that whatsoever. CBD and THC both have been touted, but that does not hold up to any sort of double-blind study. Also, there's kratom, which is it's a plant product from Southeast Asia. It's a very interesting product. It is an opioid, and you see online all the time people saying, oh, I use kratom to treat my addiction or to treat opioid withdrawal. It is an opioid. It could alleviate the symptoms of opioid withdrawal. But as I've seen written by people a lot smarter than me who are policy experts, when you have FDA-approved treatments that are known with regard to efficacy and safety, using herbal products where you don't know the safety and where the clinical trials haven't been done, you're really taking matters into your own hands. I would not suggest that people use kratom for their own detox. And if it was one or the other, I would say it's probably better as a symptom reliever for withdrawal symptoms. The use of kratom maintenance, I don't really believe that heroin maintenance is effective. Maintenance works with opioids with a particular pharmacology. Methadone is one because of its long-term storage, and buprenorphine is one because it's so attached to the
brain.
Attached to the receptor and doesn't leave. That produces maintenance, and kratom can't do that, and short-acting opioids can't do it.
Let's bring in Sam now in Fond du Lac. Hi, Sam.
Good morning.
Hi, what's on your mind?
My son is addicted to methamphetamine, and in trying to help him, at this point he's not willing, but I'm interested in the naltrexone. Is that something that works with the methamphetamine addiction?
Sam, I really appreciate your call. There are medications approved by the FDA to treat addiction involving nicotine use, alcohol use, and opioid use. Nobody has found a medication that is effective and safe to treat addiction involving cannabis use, stimulant use, including cocaine and methamphetamine, benzodiazepine use. There is no FDA-approved medication for meth, and that's very, very, very sad. When someone finds a medication that's going to treat that, interestingly, I predict it's going to be a wonderful treatment for gambling addiction because of the physiology and the anatomy involved in addiction involving gambling is the same as that for addiction involving stimulants. But methamphetamine could prove to be the next epidemic as the opioid, you know, should the opioid epidemic wane, which I think it will. And there's no specific medication for that. But addiction treatment, counseling approaches can be effective. Some people suggest that they need to be longer term than the counseling for alcohol or pot. But I'm very sorry to hear that your son has that addiction because it's a tough one.
Well, Dr. Miller, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Oh, I was very happy to be invited. It's great to be with you for your great program.
Dr. Michael Miller is a clinical instructor in the UW-Madison Addiction Medicine Fellowship Program. He's an addiction psychiatrist. He's certified in addiction medicine by the American Board of Preventive Medicine. And we've been looking at medical treatments for opioid use disorder. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the Ideas Network.